Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump indicates a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict may not be the only way. Speaking at a White House news conference Wednesday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Mr. Trump said he has also looked at a one-state solution and would be happy with one that both parties accept.
I thought for a while the two-state looked like it may be the easier of the two. But honestly, if Bibi and if the Palestinians, if Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy with the one they like the best.
For his part, Mr. Netanyahu said the Palestinians were made an obstacle to peace.
The persistent Palestinian refusal to recognize a Jewish state in any boundary, this persistent rejectionism, that's the reason we don't have peace.
Meanwhile, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas immediately reaffirmed his backing for the two-state solution that ends Israeli occupation and establishes a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Randolph-Macon College history professor Michael Fishback expressed surprise at the apparent change in longstanding U.S. policy.
The Palestinians, compared to where they were, have made huge concessions in terms of what's their bottom line. Not a defeat of Israel, not return to 1948, to take 23% of Palestine, call it a state, and leave it at that. So the ingredients have been there.
Meanwhile, Mr. Trump called on Mr. Netanyahu to pull back on Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. 6 years after an uprising that brought down longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi, Libyan factions meeting in Cairo have agreed on an Egyptian-mediated roadmap toward unity. But two leaders, Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj and the UN-backed unity government, and Khalifa Haftar, a military commander loyal to the Easter administration, failed to meet. This is VOA News. Syrian talks on shoring up a ceasefire are scheduled to get underway Thursday in the Kazakh capital, Astana, delayed by a day by the arrival of an opposition delegation which had threatened to boycott over what they called repeated government violations of the truce. It precedes next week's next round of Geneva talks on Syria's political future. UN diplomat Stefan de Mistura says the parameters are defined by Security Council Resolution 2254.
A new form of governance, a new constitution, and new elections under UN supervision.
And he rejected any change to the agenda, saying it would only open a Pandora's box of stalling and time-wasting. A U.S. commander in Iraq told Reuters Wednesday the Islamic State will put up a stiff fight for the western part of Mosul.
It's hard, and it's hard every day here, and there's no guarantee, certainly, when you're fighting. There's no timetable. It's a determined enemy that we're up against. But we have the utmost confidence that the Iraqi security forces supported by the coalition are going to be able to dominate Daesh at the point of decision.
Colonel Patrick Work, commander of the 2nd Brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division, said the IS group is being degraded daily. The U.S. is backing the effort to retake the city with artillery and air support. U.S. Defense Chief James Mattis sought Wednesday to allay concerns of the transatlantic NATO defense alliance about America's commitment to Europe. Mattis, speaking in Brussels, told his defense colleagues the alliance is central to the relationship between Washington and its European allies. But he also said NATO members must honor past military spending pledges.
And it's absolutely appropriate, as a European Minister of Defense said last week, it's a fair demand that all who benefit from the best defense in the world carry their proportionate share of the necessary cost to defend freedom. And we should never forget, ultimately, it is freedom that we defend here at NATO.
While NATO's European members and Canada have increased defense spending, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says it's not enough. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in Germany on his maiden foreign trip as America's top diplomat to attend a G20 meeting. The meeting precedes a G20 summit in Hamburg in July. The former ExxonMobil chief executive is to meet with counterparts from several European and Mideast countries, including his first encounter with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Europe's top rights institution, the Council of Europe, has urged Turkey to urgently change course and reverse violations of media freedoms and the rule of law. The call comes as Ankara prepares to put major constitutional questions to a popular referendum in April that switches to a presidential system of government. Boeing aircraft workers in South Carolina Wednesday voted overwhelmingly to reject unionization, a setback to the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Talks to end Burundi's political crisis are slated to resume today, Thursday, but the government says it will not attend.
Contacting these lawbreakers by anybody is an insult to the government of Burundi.
Jean-Claude Karewa is the spokesman for Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. Voter registration for Kenya's 2017 presidential election concludes today, Thursday. Aid agencies warn of deepening food crisis in northeast Nigeria, and South Sudan has the largest refugee crisis in Africa.
Around 700,000 have fled to Uganda. Others have gone to Sudan, Ethiopia, DRC, Central African Republic as well.
Barbara Balak is spokesperson for UNHCR. A teenage Cameroonian wins Google's Global Youth Coding Challenge, and local artists take to the stage in Burkina Faso. Those stories, plus our Black History Month facts and contests, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Talks to end Burundi's political crisis are slated to resume today, Thursday, in Arusha, Tanzania, but the Burundian government says it will not attend. The opposition coalition, known as SINARE, which had initially demanded the removal of former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa as facilitator, has changed its position and now said it will attend the talks without conditions. As Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura, the Burundian government says it will not talk to the opposition leaders who it accused of trying to overthrow President Pierre Nkurunziza in a 2015 coup attempt.
This is not the first time the Burundi government boycotts the regional mediated dialogue. Last year, the government officials walked out of the meeting room after revealing that the opposition members invited were those it accused of plotting the May 2015 Fed coup to oust the incumbent President Pierre Nkurunziza. Jean-Claude Karewa is the spokesman of President Nkurunziza.
Not only contacting these lawbreakers by anybody is an insult to the government of Burundi, but also inviting someone like Jamal Benomar, the special advisor to the Secretary General of the United Nations, while the government of the Republic of Burundi has already officially and by authorizing means withdrew its trust in him is for us unacceptable.
Another inter-Burundi dialogue round that was set to start this Thursday may not take place, as also the National Council for the Respect of Arusha Accord, SENARED, an umbrella body of the opposition mainly in exile, said it won't participate in talks as it ceased to recognize Mkapa as the facilitator. Jeremiah Minani is the communication officer of SENARED based in Belgium.
We are not taking part of his negotiations, but we are sending a high delegation in there to express again our position about the Burundi crisis and also to remind President Mkapa that we don't recognize him as a facilitator. We keep calling him to step down or at least to accept his team to be reinforced by a team from African Union and the United Nations.
SENARED had called on the African Union and the United Nations for change of the facilitator after the former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa's comments that those who were wanted by the Burundi authorities won't be invited in the talks. Agathon Rwasa is the prominent opposition leader who is currently a deputy speaker of the Burundi parliament. He said that the Burundi government should allow an inclusive dialogue.
So you cannot pretend to solve problems when you are discriminating some part of the problem. It would be better if they consider their position and accept it with everybody. After all, we need a better Burundi, and a better Burundi needs the contribution of each and everyone.
For more than 2 years now, after the Inter-Burundi Dialogue was launched, the boycotting of the dialogue by both government and opposition is yet another setback to put an end to the current political crisis that claimed more than 500 lives. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission says it will end voter registration today, Thursday, following a recent court ruling. This as the commission says it has compiled a voter list to be used for the August 8 elections. For years, Kenyans living abroad have been calling on their country's leaders and lawmakers to implement measures so that the diaspora could register to vote. Andrew Lehman, Communications Director for the Elections Commission, tells viewers Peter Clotty that this time around, Kenyans living in the East African region and South Africa will be able to register to vote in the upcoming elections.
We were to end it on the 14th. That was going to be 1 month, but someone went to the courts and the courts decided that they add 2 more days. So it's going to end today on Thursday. We also expect they will have made a decision because that was the time to give a decision to the courts so that the determination of the case would be concluded.
When will Kenyans officially know when the Electoral Commission will bring out the preliminary voter registration list for them to verify their names and information before the final one is brought out ahead of the elections in August?
This is a very important question because we know that we have had challenges with the register. We have had people with shared ID. Sometimes our clerks, when they register someone, they probably would not record a number correctly, 3 or 8 and all that. And you know, as it happens with telephone numbers, for example, if you missed out a digit or something, you probably will call someone else. So we will clean the register, and by law, on the 10th of May, the register must be ready for inspection by the members of the public, and it must be a clean register that they will check their records, and then we certify the register after 9th of June, after 1 month, and then that register is ready for the general election.
Will political parties, participating political parties, be giving soft and hard copies of the voter list or the voter register before the elections?
This will be available not only for political party. Anybody can download. We will have it on our, the entire register on our website. So people can check who is registered and where they're registered and things like that. All those details will be, it will be a public document.
For years, Kenyans living outside the country have been agitating and expressing concern that they are being sidelined from participating in the country's democratic process by not being included in the registration process, so that will allow them to vote in the countries they reside. But in the neighboring countries, East Africa and perhaps Southern Africa and elsewhere, what are the plans that the IEBC want to undertake to ensure some of these prospective Kenyan diasporan voters participate in this year's election?
Well, the law allows for progressive registration of Kenyans living outside the country. And discussions have been going on with Parliament and other stakeholders, political parties. And it has been thought they told us a while that, why don't you do Africa in 2017? And in 2022, we could go to more countries to begin with. But because of time constraints and resources, we decided we could do East Africa and add one more country, South Africa. So we will, from 20th of this month to the 6th of March, we will be undertaking the registrations of Kenyans living in Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, Tanzania, and South Africa. In Tanzania, we'll do it in Dar es Salaam and Arusha. But for the others, we will have them at our high commissions and consulates.
Andrew Limo is Director of Communications for Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barte in Washington, and today's Thursday, February 16th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. As thousands of South Sudanese refugees continue to pour into Uganda to escape attacks from armed groups, the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is sounding the alarm. It says the dire situation has created the third largest refugee crisis after Syria and Afghanistan. Viewers Mariama Diallo reports.
The ongoing violence in Africa's newest country has created the continent's largest refugee crisis. Via Skype from Geneva, Babar Baloch, UNHCR spokesperson.
We now have 1.5 million refugees that have fled South Sudan, seeking safety and taking refuge in the neighboring countries.
Uganda is the largest recipient of South Sudanese refugees.
Around 700,000 have fled to Uganda. Others have gone to Sudan, Ethiopia, DRC, Central African Republic as well. And what we have seen is that all these communities in the neighboring countries who are welcoming the South Sudanese refugees, they don't have enough themselves.
Sida Hawa and her six children recently arrived in Kuluba, a small town in northern Uganda.
I had just planted some crops and I was waiting to harvest. I lost everything because of the war. They are killing people.
Raymond Tawongo barely escaped his hometown on an old bicycle. He lost everything when his village was attacked.
Look at me. I'm wearing torn, dirty clothes. We sleep in the bush. This is a terrible situation.
Hawa and Tawongo are among the thousands of refugees streaming into Uganda since intense fighting broke out again in July following the collapse of a peace deal between the government and opposition forces. Brian Adeba says it's time to focus on the root causes of the conflict.
These charades that are taking place, like the national dialogue, which is not inclusive, the statements by JAMEC, the organization that is supposed to oversee this peace agreement, the statements that allude to the fact that, hey, everything is moving on smoothly. This is just a phantom process, and we need to recognize the peace deal for what it is. It is dead.
For that, Adeba says all the parties involved need to return to the negotiating table.
The government is a key actor in this conflict, and it needs to be at the table. The SPLM-IO in opposition, led by Dr. Riek Machar, has to be at the negotiating table as well. But we also have to be cognizant of the groups, the armed groups that have come up. There are several of them in the Equatorias and in Upper Nile that need to be brought to the table.
The Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission has called upon all the parties involved to cease all military activity. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The humanitarian crisis in northeastern Nigeria remains severe, with aid agencies reporting uneven progress. Relief organizations say they have successfully reduced malnutrition in areas they have been able to access, but in other areas still cut off by insecurity, the agencies fear the worst. Chika Udua reports from Abuja.
Rainy season is coming in northeastern Nigeria, and aid agencies are worried. The rains could start as early as April. During the lean season that follows from June to August, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization warns that 11 million people in northeast Nigeria will not have enough to eat. The FOA warns that 120,000 of those people could face famine-like conditions.
This is when people have consumed a lot of their food resources before the next harvest comes in. And so, as the name suggests, the lean season means people have, you know, less resources to cope with during that period.
Doug Mercado is the deputy country director for the UN World Food Program. He says the organization is using planes and helicopters to bring in aid.
We'll be trying to do our best to get around the insecurity issues. We've been scaling up. We've been trying to reach as many people in need as possible. We've been building up over the last few months, and in January, which was our latest distribution period, we distributed over 1 million people.
The International Committee of the Red Cross and the Nigerian Red Cross has seen a drastic reduction in cases of malnutrition at a health clinic they opened in the southern Borno town of Biu.
For the period between December and December of last year and February of this year, less than 10 admissions of severely malnourished children per month. If you compare this to last June and July, when we started working in southern Borno, at that time we would receive between 110 and 120 cases every month.
ICRC spokesperson Alexandra Mosiman told VOA the malnutrition rate among children under 5 years old has fallen from over 40 to below 10% in areas where it provides food relief. Mercy Corps reports similar results in Maiduguri and the southern part of Borno State, where they have been able to set up operations. But the group's regional humanitarian advisor, Adrian Overy, says roads are still too dangerous in eastern Borno State, where fighting continues in and around Sambisa Forest.
There may well be other parts of Borno that we haven't been able to access yet, including six of the local government areas to the north of the state, where there may be pockets of extreme malnutrition and possibly famine. But it's very hard to know until access is possible.
Some of those hard-to-reach towns in the north are along the border with Niger and near Lake Chad. Surveillance and data from militaries, foreign governments, and NGOs reveal that Boko Haram members still operate on some of Lake Chad's islands. Over the past 7 years, Boko Haram violence has displaced more than 2 million people and killed at least 20,000, according to the UN. Chika Odua for VOA News, Abuja.
A teenager in northwestern Cameroon has become the first African to win Google's Global Youth Coding Challenge. The honor has drawn global attention to the ongoing internet blackout in the teenager's hometown. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more from Bamenda, Cameroon.
Njipatik Bus Tailor Shop in Bamenda is buzzing with business and pride. His son, Collins, was recently named one of 34 grand prize winners in this year's Google Code In, a global challenge for young programmers. He used to punish his son for joking with the computer.
I was feeling that he is just spending time without doing house chores. At times, I used to seize my computer and lock it in the house, and I tell him not to use it anymore because I was believing that he's just spending time on that computer for nothing.
Nji Collins Ba has won a trip to Google headquarters in California this June with the other top finishers.
The only thing I want to say is focus on studies. Get to know more about the opportunities that are around you and go to sites which have real information about opportunities like this.
But that may be hard at the moment for his fellow students in Bamenda. In mid-January, the internet was cut to English-speaking parts of Cameroon amid ongoing unrest. Collins had to plead with his uncle for travel money so he could go to Bouda, a French-speaking town 30 kilometers away, to get online and complete. He had just a few days to complete 842 programming tasks. Many believed the government ordered the internet blackout, though there has been no official confirmation. Teachers and lawyers have been on strike in the English-speaking regions since November. They have been joined by activists calling for cessation. Some demonstrations have turned violent and dozens of people have been arrested. Officials say activists have been using social media to spread anti-government messages.
Nous voulons encourager l'utilisation des réseaux sociaux. Il faut une utilisation.
Cameroon's Minister of Post and Telecommunication, Libom Lilikeng, told VOA there has to be a responsible use of technology. She says although social networks provide lots of opportunities, they have noticed that many people use them for unhealthy purposes. African countries have been increasingly responding to unrest by cutting internet access. Uganda, Congo, and Mali are just a few other examples. Last week, a UN rights expert called the internet blackout in parts of Cameroon an appalling violation of freedom of expression. Residents in affected areas say it is impacting the economy as money transfer services and ATMs are not working. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bamenda, Cameroon.
In Burkina Faso, local artists are taken to the stage for a month-long traveling festival called Rendezvous Chenouz. Now in its eighth year, from Ouagadougou, Brian Pestermas has the story of one emerging poet who is making himself heard.
Architecte de la pensée, il y a les architectes de la matière.
No soothing West African tunes from this performer. Ali Dwesli Kwedraogo, stage name L'Architecte de la Pensée, or The Architect of the Mind, prefers the loudness of rock and a bit of reggae to get his message across. His backdrop is the popular neighborhood of Gunga in Ouagadougou. He performs on the neighborhood square surrounded by busy restaurants and bars. He was born in Abidjan, neighboring Ivory Coast, but his family moved to Burkina Faso when he was five. At school and later at university, he developed his love of theatre, writing, pen and paper if you please, no keyboard. And the union of the two, slam poetry. It's my weapon of expression, he says. Slam allows me to say what I think in a way that fits me. And so does rock. That's not some strange foreign influence in Burkina Faso. Listen to some of our traditional rhythms and singing styles. Pure rock.
That's Brian Postumus reporting from Ouagadougou. Time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts and Trivia Question for today, February 16. On this day in 1923, blues singer Bessie Smith, known as the Empress of the Blues, made her first recording. It was called Downhearted Blues. Smith sang about things in life that give people the blues, things like poverty, racism, and love that is not returned. Her songs capture the sadness and joy of many African Americans. Also on this day in 1970, Joe Frazier became world heavyweight boxing champion after knocking out Jimmy Ellis in the second round at Madison Square Garden in New York City. On this day in 1972, during a basketball game between the Los Angeles Lakers and the Phoenix Suns, Wilt Chamberlain became the first man in the history of the NBA to score 30,000 points. Today in Black History, we want to tell you about African-American composer, pianist, and big band leader Edward Kennedy Duke Ellington. Born April 29, 1899, Duke Ellington was one of the outstanding musicians in the world. He led a big band, played the piano, and wrote over 1,000 songs. Both the United States and France awarded Duke Ellington their top honors. And in African history, on this day in 1977, the Most Reverend Junani Luwam, Anglican Archbishop of Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and Boga Zaire, was killed while under arrest for sedition and arms smuggling. It was revealed that Luwam and two prominent government officials were killed on the orders of then Ugandan head of state Field Marshal Idi Amin. On this day in African history, 1923, the burial chamber of King Tutankhamun of Egypt was opened in the Valley of the Kings near Luxor. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 16. Congratulations to Vincent Maloba of Nairobi, Kenya, Samuel Hafner of KIS 104 FM in Bow City, Sierra Leone, and Dennis Udoma of Uyo in Akwa Ibom State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 15 question. Who is the first African-American to win the Miss American pageant? The answer, Vanessa Williams. Now here's our question for today, February 16. Who is the white abolitionist that led a raid on the Federal Armory in Harpers Ferry, Virginia in 1859? Once again, who is the white abolitionist that led a raid on the Federal Armory in Harpers Ferry, Virginia in 1859? Send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. Stand up for your right. Get up. And that's it for this Thursday, February 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strarek, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, U.S. President Donald Trump has made his first phone calls to African heads of state, speaking with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari and South African President Jacob Zuma. An in-depth discussion on the expectations of the president's engagement with Africa. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Next on Let's Talk, makeup. How important is it for you? Some experts say that it gives women a sense of empowerment. Do you agree with them? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing makeup. Let's Talk comes to you Monday at 17:30 UTC on VOA Africa.